Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Transform Sales Podcast. Today, I am delighted to have Harry Sims with me. How are you, Harry?
Hey, I'm fine. Thank you. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Let me tell you a bit about Harry. He was a bang average AE, which is an account executive, with a strange love for prospecting. If there's one thing he's good at, it's chasing strangers for meetings. So he did that almost every day for the last decade and built 4 SDR teams from scratch. He advised a few others. Some were great, some were not. He got lucky by hiring amazing people. Their success paid the bill. Subsequently, he pressured them to write nice things about him in his recommendation section. He publishes on www.personalprospecting.com and will never be replaced by AI automation or ad spend. The end, full stop, period. So, Harry, tell us, how did you start your career and how did you get to where you are today?
Thank you. I thought we could tell everyone how we met as well.
Oh, yeah, you should.
Yeah.
How did we meet?
Okay. Shall I go or you go?
Yeah, no, you tell the story. I want to hear the story.
So I'm at an event and I didn't really go to many events in Nashville. And Wesleyan came up to me and instantly I felt like this like warmth. And I'm not even really like a big energy person or star signs or anything. And she proceeded to like very carefully grill me. And I wanted to give her every piece of information. And then she gave me some incredible, very pointed advice. She completely got my mindset and my world. And I sat on it and thought about it for about 2 months, which I tend to do. And then one day I just decided I'm doing what she said, and it made me money. It gave me much more confidence, and it was all rooted in her experience, which is really important for me because I think we'll probably get into this in the rest of the pod, but I think good leaders should have walked in the shoes of their people. And that's exactly how I felt that day. And it really made a big impact on me. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I usually definitely don't start podcasts like that.
What?
But I want to stick there.
Okay, yes.
What you brought up. And so we met at an event and you say you don't really typically go to events.
No.
But that day, why did you go? What about this particular event drew you there?
I've seen this company Ambition for a while in the space. I actually didn't know much about what they did. Brian LaBelle, I think he's my peer over there, runs sales development. He's a really good guy. I've hired people from companies he's been at, and he invited me, and it's around the corner. And I really enjoyed it. Actually meeting people in the physical world. I'm better at approaching strangers on the internet or via email or cold calls, but it was a big opener. And I went to a Pavilion event the week before, and I was kind of like, oh my God, I should really actually start communicating with people about who they are as people instead of trying to sell them things all the time. And I regret not going to many more events in the last decade or so.
Ah, but that's good. And, you know, yeah. I think that in this post-pandemic world, we are so stuck in our offices. We're so stuck in the place that we've been in for so long. We forget about the human connection. And the dots that I want to connect for the listener are, if you are just doing what you need to do, you're inviting people to an event, you're prospecting, you're doing those things, you extend an invitation to someone, and what happens a lot of times when we're in that prospecting piece, we get disenfranchised because your prospect is not in the buying cycle,
yeah.
But you were there. You were, yeah, like, I got to get out this office. So Brian reached out to you. Boom. You went. It was an absolutely great conference. And then, yeah, this little woman comes up to you and says, what's going on?
Yeah. Yeah. And I liked how you kind of qualified my current state as well. You could have just blurted out, hey, this is what you should do. But you didn't. You kind of got to know me and demonstrated some care and trust, like to build trust. And then you pivoted towards your journey. And it was like, I was like, oh, yeah, this is a sign. This is a sign, you know. And it made a big impact on me. Thank you.
So let's talk about, again, because I think that one of the things that people don't do as often as they should is network and build these connections. So in that moment, you said, I demonstrated care and trust and connection. Can you share with the listeners specifically what I did or the questions I asked or how you felt a quick connection?
Yeah, I think the first thing is the smile, right? You're coming up from a very friendly perspective, and I think that's just a subconscious. You look like you have a lot of energy and I want to talk to you. And then I think you asked about where I am work-wise and my perspective on prospecting, and I'm very opinionated there. And I think then it transitioned to sales training and how we do that today. And I was explaining that, you know, I usually work for early stage. So I'm the ops person, the leader, the enablement person, there's SDR, the recruiter. And I think we bonded over that because I think that Gerard was talking about it on one of your pods.
Yeah.
It's a huge gap. And we kind of tag the coach, the trainer onto the role of already in a very busy human being who can't actually do a good job, even if they had all the hours in the day. It's not possible to cover the bases. And also, we live in this walled garden theory world, right, where we just look in our own walls. When you're someone like you who has perspective from all these different calls, right, and all these different environments, because you don't get that when you work for one.
Yeah.
Your actual solutions to problems are going to be much more varied and have much more volume behind them because you've seen, tried, and tested. And I think that angle is something sales leaders should look for more and just be vulnerable about their shortcomings. And guess what? There's people out there that have talked to 100 sales leaders about that very specific problem and probably worked out the solutions. You do these sales strategy audits. It's that's an incredible CTA, right? That's an incredible offer. And that's kind of, I felt like you were kind of doing that for me, but with my career, you were trying to work out where I could potentially go. And I think I told you I'd tried and failed a bit of consulting and you kind of picked up one of the problems that I was doing, which was giving a lot away for free, too much. And the moment I started just saying, hey, this is my offer. I can't do everything for free, but here's what's there. Things started changing. And I think I just needed a boost and a confidence from someone that had done it. You know, so thank you again.
And, you know, what I want to do is I want to kind of break this down because this podcast is kind of different for me and no two podcasts are the same, but almost kind of like looking at West Lean from the other side. And then I get to dissect what I did because I never remember what I tell people. It is just inherently inside me.
Yeah.
So one of the keys that I heard that you say that I did, and again, I really want to talk about this in a networking standpoint, when you meet somebody that you don't know, because I didn't know you before.
No, you didn't at all.
Right? And this is how you make networking effective.
Yeah.
So very quickly, I was able to build that know-like trust, probably within 2 or 3 minutes. And I did it by asking you really good open-ended questions that uncover the challenges or the problems that were specific to you. And when you do that, just like in a good discovery, you get people to talk about themselves, right? Yeah. And then I didn't have an agenda because I really didn't have an agenda. No. I stuck with where you were. Oh, this is the challenge that you're having. What about this? Have you tried that? Let me ask you a few more qualifying questions. And then I gave you a solution. I gave you hope, right? And so giving you just a little bit of hope, giving you just a little bit of a solution, it stuck with you. And you said you sat with it for 2 months because again, your prospects, your buyers, the people you're talking to aren't always ready.
Yeah.
Let them marinate. And so when we talk about the magical 12 to 14 touches or 20 touches, however much it takes, you have to remember that people aren't always ready to execute and act.
Yeah.
And I think that one of the things that I did for you, and I never know who I'll impact or how I'll impact them, is there was something inside you that you felt a lack of confidence about that you didn't verbalize to anyone else.
Yeah.
And because I was able to uncover that and help you find hope in a spot that felt hopeless, you were like, I got this. And then the magical thing is you came back and said, Wesleyan, I tried it.
Yeah.
I tried it. How can I help you? And now we're in this place.
Yeah. And I sent you receipts too.
Yes, you did. He sent me
screenshots.
Like,
I'm getting the big one soon. Trust me. I'm getting the big ones and I'm going to show them to you.
Yes. Yeah. Every win. And you know, somebody told me, one of my friends was like, Wesleyan, you're the biggest hype man. I said, no, I'm a woman. Like, I'm the biggest hype woman. I am the hype woman because we have to celebrate our successes.
Yes.
So let's kind of roll back and let's kind of talk about you professionally. Some of the things that you have, what would you say is the biggest struggle that in your career building these teams and working in startups that you've had to overcome?
I've only recently even got to a good place with it. It's I usually build the first outbound motion that a company has. And I usually am the first person running it, finding the plays and scaling a team if I can. There are so many variables completely out of your control that I wasted a lot of time worrying about, and even just like sometimes just throwing my hands up and being like, well, I can't win, right? And I think that was the wrong perspective. The perspective that I tried to settle on now is, and I'll give you some examples of the variables, right? Market turning, competitors doing something different, stuff you're not even aware of, to be honest. And we attribute cause to these things without ever knowing if that really is the cause. So deals not closing, AEs not doing their job with the opportunities that you run, people on your team not doing what they should be doing, like lots of these things are actually out of your direct control. You can have an influence or be aware of them, which is useful, but seeking to control them is never going to work. Mm-hmm. And the perspective I try to like land on now, and I have to remind myself, is that this is all just one big game and an experiment, and you don't always win. And losing is actually the best piece of feedback you can get. And you have a sandbox. Imagine like, I don't know if you're a gamer or not, but I'm not even really a gamer, but I see it. There's these games like Skyrim, right? Skyrim is one of those games you can run around in the big world and do all this crazy stuff like Zelda. Mm-hmm. And there's games like Tetris, right? Mm-hmm. Where there's very limited things you can do, but it's safe and easy and controllable. Skyrim, there's mad stuff going on. You have to first make a decision. Do you want to play Skyrim or do you want to play Tetris? Mm-hmm. I'm an early stage guy. I want to play Skyrim. I want to run around and kill monsters and try and work out like new things that no one's ever done, because that's what gives me joy. But the consequence of that is you don't know what's coming. You don't know what's in the forest around the corner. And instead of worrying about it, you kind of have to just run into it and be like, hey, and react. And especially early stage, especially today, I think having that kind of experimental, I'm going to figure it out, I'm going to keep trying different things, I don't like, you know, too much stagnation, is been much better for my life, my people that I work with as well. And there's lots of ways that translates into the sales org, but we can get into that and you know, later if you want.
Yeah. And so, you know, I think that one of the most profound things that you said is you have to decide. And I like to say we have to pre-decide what we're going to do.
Yeah.
Because when I'm working with organizations, it's like they want to change 10 things at one time. And my chemist brain will not allow me to do that, right? One variable at a time. Okay, just one thing, right? And because if we change too much at one time, as you said, we don't know what works. Place of this early stage motion and you're trying to get quick wins. How do you decide what to change, when to change, if something is successful or not successful?
Yeah. Oh, that's for me. I was going to ask you for the scientific method, but we should. I remember it now. You were telling me about your transition from chemistry at the event. It's another thing. Your story was very good. Your storytelling. And that's, you know, we all know about that. How do we decide? It depends on every single play. But I highly recommend that everyone focuses on finding efficiency first. And you need to find efficiency between your inputs and outputs. And here's some examples. A healthy real reply rate. I want to receive a reply from 1 in 4 buyers. It's 25%. Okay, that's an easy stat everyone can measure, and that's on across all channels. Account hit rate or contact hit rate. Active accounts, 100 in a month, and you want to book 10 meetings, you have a 10% account hit rate. There's lots of other efficiency metrics you can look at, but those are just really simple ones. And start with your crawl. The crawl is, for 100 contacts, my goal is this. Real reply rate, account hit rate. And just focus there. Keep consistency with your targeting, who, why, when. Your offers, 1 or 2 offers, not too many. It's got to be more than a meetings with sales, a sales strategy audit. That is a perfect educational event. And you've got to be consistently in how you measure. And all that stuff comes before you start talking about cadences, tools, processes, blah, blah, all the boring stuff, to be honest. And you define your crawl. And if you can hit your crawl, you then go to run. And run is, hey, I'm going to add 5 volume, same audience, same targeting, same offers. I'm going to tweak this and this in my messaging. I'm going to try different variations. But guess what? I'm going to go for 40% real reply rate. I'm going to go for a 25% account hit rate. And it's this crawl, walk, run. Before you add volume, you focus on efficiency. Because if you don't have efficiency at the start, you go nowhere. Because as you add volume, typically, not always, your efficiency is going to go down. That's just the nature of humans. We think we have like, something interrupts our pattern, we respond to it, but over time it becomes less effective, right? So that's kind of how I think early stage. But again, every sort of environment and play is slightly different.
And so I always think about these things kind of like building blocks, like Lego, right? So we have our efficiency, we have our I like to call them KPIs, like the things that we're looking at, leading, lagging indicators, and now we're ready to run. How do we know when we're ready to run?
So it's interesting. My recent role, I'm leaving tomorrow. I was in product-led growth world. So run for me was move the play to the product or automate.
Wait, I'm sorry. Did you say you're leaving your role tomorrow?
Yeah.
So you're going to a new company?
I will be soon. It's not quite finished yet, but
Oh, okay.
Like, why am I interviewing this guy? He's not even really employed.
Yeah, that's fine. I just heard that. Go ahead.
Product-led growth. Yeah, so the run for us, the Nirvana, if it was possible, was slow manual outreach is me. A bit faster, higher volume outreach is me. But then the run and the rocket, the spaceship, is let's build this experience into product. And then maybe let's automate parts of it so you can add real volume without it costing you a load of time. That was the Nirvana I was in. I was trying to find that. We had a couple that should have been built into product. They still may be. But the run side is, it's really, because I think of players as starting with targeting. You have to have the audience available to add the volume. And I promote puddles. Very small pockets of your ICP is the starting point. So what you have to first do is see, do we have the available pool of people, right? Mm-hmm. And I did this with user gems and a champion chasing and tracking job changes quite well at Scratchpad. User gems just gave us incredible volume because we were able to use product data to identify champions we didn't know existed because they'd never interacted with us team, go-to-market team, or support. They'd just been using the product. Mm. So we had no idea who they were, and user gems allowed us to identify those. So first find the volume, but then keep an eye on efficiency as you drive that volume through. If you can maintain efficiency or just slightly dip, you're winning at that point. But I'll tell you, the big change I'm seeing in early stage outbound is people don't have a play anymore. They have about six, and they rapidly iterate and have to try and find new ones constantly because you get this advantage and it works for a quarter, and then the next quarter something happens. And I think that's where some of the green SDRs struggle, mm-hmm. or the leaders that push this top-down, very formulaic playbook, because by the time you've written the playbook, trained it, coached it, enabled the team, then got data to see if it's working, it's too late. You're behind. Mm. It's fish and chip paper. Mm-hmm. You're probably fired in today's early stage SaaS world. You see it. Am I wrong?
No.
Get about 9 months if you're lucky.
It is actually, I mean, and the thing that you're saying, it is, this is the reason why the turnover is so high. But I do think that this is an education that has to happen between whoever the sales leader is and the CEO, because they have to understand, like, we don't have a lot of data. We don't have historical data. You come from an established company. You come from something that worked. We are establishing our data. Yeah. We think we know who the ICP is. We think we know what their problems, their pains, how they receive information, but we don't know.
Yeah.
So as a new leader, it is your job to advocate for yourself and to allow yourself to have the rope that you need to actually get to that point of, as you said, that efficiency, so you can start walking and then running, because every CEO wants you to run.
Yeah.
They too run. And you're like, but hold on.
I think you can run fast to find efficiency in plays and processes. You can iterate. But it's like actually the process of finding one that's consistent and works for a long time over and over and over again. That's not a fast thing. You just actually reminded me. The answer should have been when you asked me that original question about run is like, when do we have healthy close rates? Mm-hmm. That's actually the answer, because that's a product market fit thing. And then if you're there long enough, which I'm not always, you then look, do we have a healthy churn, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's very possible that the people you're adding to the funnel from outbound are not good fits, but you don't know until they churn. Yeah. But that's not, I don't think that's because of outbound tactics. That's a targeting issue. They would come in the funnel if you targeted them with ads as well. But that's very possible. And I've been there. I've been at an early stage startup. The first 40 customers, about 20 churned. Do you know why they churned? Because the deals were done for favors from, you know, the investor favors, the board intros, and they felt obliged to buy this thing that they didn't really need.
And you know, the crazy thing about that is it is why typically a new sales leader, a new sales rep, their first 6 months or so, they're just living off of the love of the last person. They're living off of the favors of somebody. And then the real proof comes to it when you have to actually get out there and work. When you actually have to find the new people, when all of those deals, those leftover deals, kind of like you're saying, like that your churn rate is like, oh my gosh, my pop line is so soft. And it's because you haven't actually learned how to do anything but just pull people through.
Do you know why I'm laughing so much? Because that's why I say I'm a bang average age. I made President's Club in Tahiti from basically a blow-in deal that a rep. Actually, there was kind of two blow-in deals. Significant. One of them was seven figures. Mm. I did no work for it. And as soon as those deals were done, I was in the hole. It was a big enterprise sales motion. I was like 24, 25. And I was woefully out of my depth. I even put it on my LinkedIn, I say, this was a lucky President's Club, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there you go. It happens. Trust me.
It does. I mean, and you know, that kind of goes to the thing I talk about in terms of reps actually knowing how to sell versus just nurturing accounts and just being in the right place at the right time. Because the thing is a true salesperson, and I say this all the time, a real salesperson, whether they've been in their role for 5 months or 5 years, if you take them and put them in a completely different territory, a completely different company, the ones that are actually good will survive because they have the skills.
Yes.
The ones that aren't good, that have been just living on this love, they're going to flounder.
Yep. And I think it was a bit, I actually did well at the next company, but it was because I was so like unaware at that time. I just decided to sell something completely different than everyone else was selling, and it worked out. And that was the role that I got after the first year of actually selling things. They're like, we need more new business. And I was like, okay, that was my chance to go and be in the SDR world. And it was always what I was good at. I was good at opening, running the first meeting, and then so bad at all the actual stuff that AEs get paid for. Mm. The dark arts that don't feel like dark arts. I was terrible at it. So bad. I think I probably still am.
So you defer on the side of being the door opener rather than being the closer.
Yes. I'm always going to be that. And actually, Dad, I don't want to be a VP. I don't want to be maybe be a CEO, but maybe be in product. But all I want to be is frontline leader, frontline operator, IC. That's what I love. I get up at 5 a.m. and it's one of my favorite things in the world. Everyone else is asleep. I'm prospecting and I'm addicted to it. I'm absolutely obsessed with it. And it's really weird because everyone else uses it as a stepping stone or they avoid it. But I couldn't be happier doing it. It's so weird.
And you know, I really think that as people, as humans, it's important for us to know that, right? Like I was literally just talking to a new client I'm onboarding. We were talking about their team and he was like, yep, these two salespeople, they're really, really good, but I don't see that they ever want to go into management. They just really want to stay where they are. And I was like, we all need those people. As a business owner, I don't need a bunch of people who want to start their own business because I need employees, right? Yeah. And everybody doesn't have to be a manager. And understanding where your strengths lie is really important. Like I will tell everybody, I am the visionary. I am not the execution person. Mm. If you would have said, Wesleyan, can you send me an email and line out all the things that you said that you told me to do? I'd be like, I'm sorry. I don't even remember because I'm the visionary and I know where my strength lies. And the problem that we have in so many companies is people try to be everything. They try to do all the things. And when you are not operating your excellence, just like you mentioned, you don't get fulfilled and you don't do a good job.
I've seen it. Early stage, it's just the common. There'll be the very, very capable ops person who gets given 7 jobs and they accept them because it's part of their character. I am the person who gets stuff done on time. I execute. And then it's not that they struggle. They struggle like internally and in their personal life, but work you'll never know. I bet you can execute though. I know you have ideas, but I bet you wouldn't be where you were if you couldn't.
Okay, let's talk about that, right? Yeah. So when I say that I can't execute, what I mean in terms of execution is I am not operating in my best self if I have to sit down because like we make sales playbooks for people. But if I sit here and actually have to write the playbook, like I can do it. I don't enjoy it. And it takes me forever because I don't like doing it. But I mean, I started a business all by myself. So everything that we do in the business, I know how to do it. I just don't enjoy it, right?
Your operations are clean as well. Like this whole booking this, all the different setup. I know you can do it. I knew I heard that wrong.
You're like, let me clarify that. Yeah, I was like, make sure that she's not throwing herself under the bus.
Hey, if you want to have an argument over playbooks, we can. I'll go. I'm pretty opinionated on this, but I will say to you on the playbook, it doesn't like you writing the playbook for them. I don't think teaches them much because unless it's your own work and you have autonomy around it, you don't really have that sense of ownership. And if you miss that sense of ownership, I think there's too much of a gap between it's my responsibility to improve this because you know this. You know all the big sales vendors, the big force management and all these, right? They'll spend 18 months rolling something out, then the CRO will go and then it's done. Yeah. They don't even remember it. One or two of the, you know, and I can't speak for everything. I hear this a lot. And maybe a new leader comes in with a new playbook and like it's too slow.
Yeah.
That's my two cents. However, you got to remember my perspective, my walled garden is just really early stage companies that were figuring it out. So I think it's completely different in lots of other environments, and you've probably seen it.
Yeah. So, you know, in the industries that I work in, they are, and there's a gamut, you know, the organizations that we're typically working on their onboarding and their playbook and all those things. I call them, they're really companies that the founder still has a hand in sales.
Okay.
And so the founder is either onboarding or hiring that first sales manager. And they're like, I hired some salespeople before. I hired some sales managers before, and it didn't really work out. And I'm like, because the process is in your brain.
Yeah.
So I am a process person. This is my chemist's brain.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so literally, we're not writing the playbooks for them. I'm sitting down and interviewing Harry. And I'm like, okay, Harry, so tell me when this happens, what do you do? Then what do you do? How do you handle this objection? How do you tell this person that? And so what it does is it removes all the knowledge from the founder's brain. Sometimes it's a sales leader from their brain, and we actually can map it out, and it helps them onboard their new salespeople faster because it's not in their brain.
Yes. Yeah. So I think, maybe you just changed my mind.
I changed your mind. Okay. What are you noodling on? What are you noodling?
Well, it's because it's first party data. You're interviewing the people that have the best perspective at that moment, probably. And then maybe this is a new product for you. That should be refreshed every month or quarter.
It is.
There you go.
So it's a living document, right? Ah. So we get it, and then we know it has to be updated. And then they see it. They're like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. The question I get is, where did all this come from? I'm like, this is from your head.
Yes.
So like, this is from your brain. So when I say I'm the visionary, not the execution person, I will have a 60-minute interview with someone, and I'm extracting all the bits and pieces, and my operations person listens to that, and she's putting all it together and mapping it out and doing all the things. And so again, as things change, they're like, we don't like that ICP anymore. Nope, this didn't work. We're getting all these new objections. Hey, we got to update this. So it's a living document, and it's not stale. And the key for this is it really helps in onboarding, because that's where a lot of companies lack. They have all of the product knowledge, all of those things, but they don't really have like, this is how it works from a sales process.
Yeah.
This is how it works from that standpoint. So that's our secret little sauce.
There you go. Hey, maybe we just change the name, because a book suggests there's a beginning, middle, and end.
Okay. All right. What are we going to call this, Harry? Playlist. Come on.
The playlist.
Sales playlist. I like it.
Yeah. And then that kind of suggests autonomy, because you get to pick the tunes that you like. Based on what's happening in front of you. There you go.
The sales.
I'm going to take that one though. So that's mine.
Hey, okay. You can have it.
You can have it. Pull the hell.
Look, we can share it. There is enough. I love saying there is enough cake for everybody to have a slice.
Oh, yeah.
There's enough cake. Okay, Harry. So I want you to share with us a situation in your life, personally or professionally, that has impacted the way that you show up in the world today.
Oh, a big one. Having a daughter is a massive one. I think, I don't know how deep I want to get here. Men like me, I don't say all men, we're basically teenagers up until, or for me anyway, until I had my daughter. Actually, probably to about 6 months into having my daughter, I was effectively a teenager who was older. Having my daughter gives me a different everything, different perspective on women, different perspective on myself, how I like my physical self, my work. It helps me be much calmer because literally none of this matters. If I can focus on trying to be good for her, then everything else will fall into place. And that's kind of the anchor. That's a big one. And then me moving to America from London, I moved to LA in 2000. That was a massive culture shock. I still fail this often. In England, we're very direct, and it's actually a respect thing. Like, there's some communities in America and some place I've been where that's the same. And we're also like, when we joke with you and when we like, you know, I'm laughing and joking a bit, that means I like you. It doesn't mean that I disrespect you or and just that culture shock. And I've felt it many, many times over the last few years, and I still do. Mm-hmm. But that was another big impact. Like, it's important to like read the room, and I still don't do it very well. But so those two things are big things, massive things.
I love that. I love that. It's amazing how children can change our perspective on life, the way that we view things, the way that we think about things.
Yeah.
And also, you know, moving. I've traveled a good little bit across the world. And what I know is different places, even in the US, different things are acceptable and some things are not, right? Yep. And then, you know, when you're in Norway or you're in London versus being in Houston, Texas,
yeah,
you have to adapt to what those cultural norms are. And so I can just imagine like moving across the world. Yeah. How much that has impacted you.
But I think it's also like, I find it fascinating, like different like microcultures and different places. Like that's the joy of one of the joys of my life. Like I seek it. And London, it's built into where you're from. And also you're around people from everywhere and you become fascinated by it.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's a good one. Which was your favorite country you've been to so far?
Well, you know, favorite kind of depends on what kind of favorite we're talking about. Okay. I'd say Bermuda.
Oh yeah.
Because that pink sand and that blue water, I absolutely love.
Yeah.
I love Bermuda the most. Sure. Just in terms of countries that I visited, I think I actually do like London because I really enjoy the diversity. Mm-hmm. And so anytime I can go somewhere and I can see people, because Houston, that's where I live, yeah, it's like a melting pot. Like yeah, there's everybody from all over the world here. And so in London, I felt the same way. Right. Yeah. I felt like it was so diverse and there were so, and people are welcoming and warm, even though you say they're direct. It's some places you go to and they just stare at you like, who are you? What yeah, are you doing here? You know what I mean? But I didn't get that. Like in Germany. Oh. Yeah. They just stare at me because they're not used to seeing Black people, I guess. Yeah. So it's like, what are you doing here? Whereas in London, I didn't get that feeling.
No. Yeah, I get that. I hear that from everyone I speak to about London. I'm actually quite proud of it, to be honest. I didn't contribute anything to it, but I'm proud that that's how people that go there like come away with that feeling.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Harry, this has been an amazing conversation. Tell us, how can people get in contact with you?
I just LinkedIn, Harry Sims. I have a website, personal. I barely update it, so probably don't even bother going on there. And if anyone's listening, I really recommend you have a call with this lovely lady because she will tweak your journey, I bet, and it'll have a big impact. And thank you again.
Thank you so much. Thank you. That has been another episode of the Transform Sales Podcast. And remember, in all that you do, transform your sales. Until next time.